With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Everyone, John Wertheim here, and it's this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. I am fresh back from Australia, back from Melbourne, and thoroughly jet-lagged, but not so jet-lagged that it will prevent me from talking about the Australian Open 2018, wrapping it up with Jamie Lasanti. We have made a vow to involve Jamie more on our podcasts. So good to be doing this with you. I don't know how you want to do this. Pepper me with questions. I'm also curious on your take consuming this event stateside. Always one of these strange events where, you know, these matches are starting sometimes at 4 or 5 in the morning, and it feels like different months, much less different days in Australia versus the U.S. But it's sort of the quirky event that always ends up on an up note, and that seemed to be the case this year. A lot of strange results, unfortunately a lot of injuries that we can talk about, but in the end, what will people remember? They will remember Caroline Wozniacki breaking through, winning her first major, and of course they will remember the last image of the tournament, which is Roger Federer beating Marin Cilic, Grand Slam number 20, defending. Here is a 36-year-old man, father of four, and he has won, Jamie Lasanti, three of the last five majors, go figure. This is sort of a metaphor for tennis in general. It is a sport that succeeds in spite of itself. Anyway, good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Whatever it is. Feels like it's
meal?
April.
Yeah, what exactly. Meal are you going to eat?
That's a good way to do it. All we have had is iced coffee. It feels like it's like April. Has baseball season started yet?
This is the only time of the year where I don't know whether or not I should be drinking coffee or not. Like the other night, I had to wait until like 4:45 to I brewed it, but I there's something about me that I couldn't pour it. Into 3 a.m. coffee is a weird place. It's a weird thing.
I feel like you get the jet lag without the jet.
Yeah.
You're waking up and doing superior work producing tennis coverage from back home. This is a strange
it's
event.
It's a dark place at like 3:30 in the morning, but tennis Twitter helps you because there are a bunch of crazy people who also wake up.
That's so funny.
It's not part
that.
Of their job. They actually wake up to watch, and then they go to work, which is pretty impressive. So it's nice to see the random people who wake up and then fall asleep and then wake up and something crazy has happened, or, you know, the match is completely different than it was when they fell asleep. So it's exciting.
Who said it? Charles Barkley. I'm sure he didn't say this originally, but I've heard him say this. You sleep when you die. But it's actually funny. You see this on tennis Twitter and you say, wait, they're not in Australia. And you say, oh my God, it's 3:30 in the morning and they're watching this match. I'm curious. Pepper me with any questions you like, but I am curious how you took this event in. Because, you know, last year, 2017, we had Roger Federer come in, seeded 17th, nobody quite knew what he had in store. Would it back hold up? Was this sort of a victory lap? It was hard to believe. I mean, this was only, 54 weeks ago, but this was the Murray Djokovic age seemed to have supplanted the Federer-Nadal age. And what happened in Australia last year? We had Roger Rafa in a five-set final, a typical classic match. Federer was back, and little did we know that was only going to catalyze his entire season. Same for Nadal. We also had Venus playing Serena in the final. This year, a little different. Obviously, Serena not there for good reason. Venus Williams did not have a particularly successful go of it. Lost by about lunchtime on the first Monday. Sloane Stephens, our reigning Grand Slam champion, has really had a tough go of it. She lost the first day. We had, you know, Andy Murray not post, Novak Djokovic, even from his first match against Donald Young, it was clear that something was still awry with that right elbow of his. Dan Wawrinka clearly came back from injury too soon. First week, a little sketchy, a little patchy. Some of the, you know, Zverev lost, so we didn't have the young gun angle. Again, Roger Federer saved the event in the end, and Wozniacki as well on the women's side. But Australian Open 2018, a much different tournament than Australian Open 2017. That I will say.
Somehow everything always works out by that second Sunday, second Monday. You think, like, the first week, you're like, oh, gosh, what's going to happen the second week? And then things do fall into place. I wanted to ask you about the injuries because, as you said, most of everything you said was, you know, besides Sloane Stephens, it was kind of a result of lingering injuries from 2017. First, Nadal, his injury, had to retire, which never happens. He never quits. And do you think it's his iliopsoas muscle, is that correct? So sort of the muscle that comes all the way from your back to your front of your thigh, right, that kind of helps you move that leg and hip flexion and all this stuff. So very important. My concern is that a small muscle tweak, minor injury, as they say, is this something that could, if he's not treating it right, not taking the time to heal, that could extend into an injury like something like Andy Murray has that's a little bit more serious? He's out for a long time? Or do you think he'll be able to sort of nip it in the bud and be back?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you saw him in that match, and Nadal's number one seed. He's playing Nadal tennis. Good match against Cilic. He's up 2-1. He has this crazy celebration, and then you saw something happen. He pinpointed when exactly it happened, which actually I think was something of a relief, that it was one point in particular. It wasn't just one of these cumulative workload injuries. Mm-hmm. This was a new one for Nadal as far as we saw. But, you know, he was sort of getting treatment on a hip. And anytime tennis injuries and hips tend not to go, you know, tennis careers and hip injuries don't tend to play well with each other, as we see with Andy Murray. And to see Nadal in a quarterfinal of a Grand Slam just pull the ripcord, as we say, and retire. You figured something was really bad. He was, just to get to his press conference, he was clearly laboring. He said, oh boy, this is not good. The next day he gets an MRI, and as you say, it is that psoas injury that a number of players have had. I try not to speculate on injury. That said, when the camp sends word saying 3 weeks, that I take as a fairly good sign. I think there's a larger question that Nadal raised about why is it that
was my next
four of them are currently injured.
Yeah.
Ironically, the oldest is healthy. I think Roger Federer is becoming a little bit the exception that proves the rule. I mean, I think people are saying, well, how bad can tennis be? How hazardous can it be when this guy who's 36 years old is still healthy? But boy, injuries are a big part of the sport right now. And whether it is the string technology, I mean, you know, Mary and I talked about this on the podcast a few weeks ago, whether it's the string technology, the open stances, hardcore tennis, overtraining, whatever it is, something ain't quite right. And injuries are playing way too big a role in this. And I think, you know, things like retirements and matches played tend to be proxies. I mean, I'm not sure that's the best way to determine whether the sport is getting less healthy, but there are metrics on work rate and exertion and intensity. Those seem to be going way up. One of the data guys at Tennis Australia was telling me that if you look at exertion, Djokovic and Murray have played as much hardcore tennis for their career as Roger Federer has, even though they've been on tour for, you know, five fewer years, and that's because they work so much harder. So it's unfortunate. I mean, again, Roger Federer sort of cloaks a lot of this, and this is to his credit. This is not a knock. He clearly, whether it's scheduling or whether it's his flexibility or whether it's his team, he's clearly doing something right. But it's unfortunate that we're not out of January and four of the top five stars in the men's game are all in various states of disrepair. I think for Nadal, you asked about him specifically. Here's someone who's knows about injuries. He's been battling various injuries, all sorts of injuries, you know, backs and knees and wrists. I mean, that's one of the troubling parts, too, that all sort of different body parts are being implicated. I think this is a new one for Nadal, but this is someone who knows about managing recovery and rehabilitation. He's supposed to play an event in Acapulco, and if you go by this 3-week statement that his camp released, he should be able to still make that. So The good news is that doesn't appear to impact his schedule. You raise a good question. A lot of times we see players get a minor injury and then overcompensate. So an ankle injury becomes a knee injury.
Yeah.
You hope that's not the case. Again, Nadal is a player who at this stage in the game is very experienced about playing with pain, playing through pain, what's manageable, what would be his best advice to take some time off. But, you know, he's still ranked number one. Funny enough, if Federer had won one of those matches in London, if he had beaten David Goffin in London, Federer would have overtaken Nadal by winning the Australian Open. But you hope for Nadal, he's healthy. You hope to see him in Indian Wells and Miami, and then obviously onto the clay. I mean, I think one story that is going to be interesting and worth following: does Roger Federer do what he did last year and take off the clay season, or, especially if the king of clay, Nadal, is less than 100%, does Roger Federer say, wait a second, yeah, clay tends to be my toughest surface and it demands the most of me physically, but let's see, I've won three of the last five majors. I can play on this stuff. I have won the French Open. The one guy who I probably won't beat even on my best day is either not playing or not 100%. If Nadal isn't 100%, or let's say Nadal doesn't play the French Open, Can you think of a player you would pit Federer against in a best-of-five match that you would bet on beating him? I mean, I think Roger Federer, if Rafa Nadal is not in the draw, Novak Djokovic doesn't make a radical improvement, Wawrinka doesn't make a radical improvement, if Rafa Nadal is not in the draw, I think Roger Federer today might be your French Open favorite. Why would he not give that a go and go for number 21?
Conversely, though, I think that if Nadal thinks about scheduling as a way that Federer has in the past, or, you know, we talk about Serena kind of doing the same thing with her schedule, tailoring it. She's not playing as much and she's really streamlining it. What if Nadal decides, you know what, like Federer did last year, I'm going for Wimbledon. He says, I'm going for this French Open title. So he sort of tailors his schedule, and, you know, maybe he, if the injury doesn't get better or something, he skips some of those smaller tournaments, doesn't play certain part of the spring season and just go straight into preparing for the French. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, that wouldn't be great. No, I mean, that wouldn't be. If Nadal said, you know what, I don't need to play Indian Wells and Miami, or I don't need to play four events leading up to the French Open, I could definitely see that. I mean, I think that's something we're seeing in all sports, that we have this moment now where careers are going longer than ever. As we record this, we are 6 days away from a 40-year-old man as the favorite to quarterback the winning Super Bowl team. We see, you know, Floyd Mayweather. We see this in all across the board. We're seeing careers expand and elongate. And I think part of that is technology, and part of that is science, and part of that is knee surgeries that used to take 9 months to recover from, now take 9 weeks. But I think part of that is also that athletes are choosing their schedules more prudently and are willing. You know, LeBron James isn't going to play 82 regular season games. And if that means he's adding a few years to his career, that's great. Serena Williams is not going to play 18 events. And if that means she's still going strong at 36 and after giving birth, that's great. Roger Federer can skip the clay. So I think athletes are realizing that there's a long game to be played here with their scheduling, and they're willing to give up, whether it's bonuses or whether it's rankings, they're prioritizing a longer career over sort of the week in, week out benefits to playing a full schedule. So back to long-winded way of saying that if Nadal, like Federer, made some alterations in his schedule to really prioritize things like winning another French Open, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
I wanted to ask you about some players that either impressed you the most during Australia, or some players that sort of, not disappointed, but maybe made you worry a little bit more about, you know, what's going on, what they're doing. One person that came to mind for me for the latter was Madison Keys. I mean, she, not that she had a bad tournament, but she plays the first week. She plays like near perfect tennis for, you know, 7 days. And then she gets in the quarterfinals and she can only win three games against Kerber. Is that a product of Madison Keys fighting nerves again, or just Madison Keys, is that her? Or was that just really Kerber playing out of her mind, sort of really elevating her game this week.
That's a good one. Yeah, I would say kind of a B grade for Madison Keys. Great first week. She's coming off at the previous major at the U.S. Open 2017. She reaches the final. Doesn't have much response. You know, wins six matches, plays great, and then the seventh match does not play great. Has a really rough day at the office. And that was a little bit the pattern in Australia, where for the first week, as you say, she looked terrific. She had the best serving stats of anyone. She was cruising through her matches. And then against Kerber, she really had no answers. And I think we see this. I mean, I think some of this is a function of her game. And we see this with big, flat, you know, heavy players. There's not always a ton of plan B. You know, if they're hitting their marks, great. And if they're not, it could be a long day at the office. I think the other thing, too, is a lot of times in sports, certainly in tennis, we see these comebacks, right? So we see, you know, Pliskova get on the board, a point for 4-0 against Halep, and Halep storms back and wins the match, and we see these sways in momentum. A lot of times, though, we have the opposite, which is a player gets off to a rough start. You know, Madison Keys gets in a deficit in a hurry, and then instead of clawing her way back in the match, she starts to go for too much. And I think some of this is Kerber, I think, is a singularly bad opponent for Madison Keys. The lefty look is always difficult. She gets a lot of balls back. She's probably close to being a comparable athlete. But Madison Keys just didn't really have many answers. And that match got away from her in a hurry. And again, instead of changing tactics or instead of I don't want to say problem solve, but instead of sort of changing things up, I think Madison Keys just went for too much. I mean, I was right there on the court for that match, and mm-hmm. It just flew by.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was 52 minutes or something like that. And so, yeah, does Madison Keys, is the takeaway, I can beat anyone on any given day, and for the first four rounds I look like a world beater, or is it this was another big match where I didn't post much? So, I mean, I think there's a lot to like about Madison Keys' game.
She needs to find that quote-unquote plan B in order to really break through.
Yeah, there wasn't. Instead of sort of reassessing during the match and making some adjustments, it was the opposite, where she just went for more and more. And again, she had one of those. I mean, I think Kerber had seven errors in that match. So obviously she was getting.
Help.
Yeah, that doesn't help either. Exactly, and I'm sure Madison Keys watched
that back and was, I mean, and but that's not unlike how Stevens played in that final.
Same thing.
She
exactly.
really, like, at one point, she anything she hit, I mean, it was just everything was going her way. So I don't know, but I there must be something to be said about Keys getting herself in that kind of situation, or finding herself in that, maybe not getting herself, but finding herself in those kind of matches more than once. One thing to, you know, an opponent on a day where they're just unbelievable. They can't, you know, everything goes their way. But if she kind of keeps finding herself in that space, I think, like you said, there's got to be something. She's got to win the big one day, I think. It's just like sort of like Wozniacki sort of figured out the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think Halep is in that conversation. She's probably even more urgently than than Keys, as someone who you just are waiting for them to break through. I mean, I do think some of these matches we conflate. I mean, I think there is a conflation. Some of these matches we separate, like who played poorly, who played well, who choked, who met the moment. And the more you watch these matches, you realize that we don't have these gradations like that. It's all, everything fits together. Mm. So a lefty opponent who's not missing balls makes you go for too much, and she's playing well, but you're not playing your game. And I think I think people sometimes just look at a stat sheet and say, you know, who choked, who came back, who had a weak mental performance, and, you know, who played poorly, who played well. But I think it all sort of, it's sort of one complex mosaic on the court. And I think specific to Keys, I think part of it is just probability wise. She hits such a big ball that at some point she's going to win 14 sets over 2 weeks. She's going to win those seven matches. But yeah, it's weird because those are two majors where she's made nice runs and she's made it to the second week and there's a lot to like, but also two matches where I don't want to say she hasn't shown up, but these were not three set battles that she lost 6-4 in the third. I mean, these were two, the U.S. Open final and that match that you referenced, Jamie, with Kerber, are two matches that were just lopsided under an hour.
You want to talk about Halep for a bit? Obviously, kind of heartbreaking. A lot of people were torn going into that final because even, you know, Wozniacki said it herself, someone was going to walk away kind of really disappointed, right? I mean, it was...
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Everything was sort of on the line for both players. I mean, hell of a match.
Halep
literally played in probably the three matches of the tournament. You know, she played unbelievable. I mean, I had people watching that Lauren Davis match, that third set. I had people who openly dislike tennis or just have no care for tennis watching that third
openly
set.
Openly dislike tennis.
I know. I don't even know why watching that third set with Lauren Davis. So you got a feel for Halep. She went... Got treatment at the hospital, apparently overnight.
It's like MMA. That's what I mean. Yeah. No, again, we talk about injuries. I mean, at some level, if nothing else, with these injuries and with Halep getting an IV and going to the hospital after playing in a Grand Slam final, it does sort of splinter the myth that tennis is this this sort of fey country club sport. The flip side is this should not be happening. I think you know you're right. I mean, somebody said, "Who should I root for?" And you say, "Boy, there's going to be somebody who's going to be profoundly disappointed. There's going to be a first-time Grand Slam champion. Whoever won was going to take over number one." In as much as we should care about these things, both Wozniacki and Halep, I think, are two generally likable professional figures. They're close in age. Maybe it was just one of those matches to sit back and enjoy. For Wozniacki, she gets to the U.S. Open final in 2009 as a teenager, and it's a nice run. But I don't know if she was a severe underdog against Kim Clijsters. She gets back to the U.S. Open final with Serena Williams, and again is a severe underdog. This was a final that she had a real chance at winning. I mean, this was going to feel different to her had she lost that match, her third Grand Slam final. And as for Halep, I think she walks away from this saying, at the one hand, yes, this was another opportunity where I wasn't able to close, but given her tournament, given the context, given, as you say, the wars she had earlier in the tournament, that semifinal match is as good a match as there was, male or female, the entire tournament. That Kerber semifinal was just terrific theater. I think Halep can't be too profoundly disappointed. I mean, obviously, she was a few games away from winning her first major, but in the big picture, the fact that she was just in the third set of a final when she had ample opportunity in the previous rounds to have... been bounced. I think she's probably happy just to have been there. Again, it's a little like, obviously a completely different type of player, but not unlike Madison Keys. I think Halep is too good not to eventually win a major. There's just too much game and athleticism there. The French Open is obviously, if the draw were today and we assume she's healthy and recovered from her ankle injury and her dehydration, she's probably your favorite. But I think the other thing too is we always prefer when Serena Williams is in the draw, but I thought the women's matches were overall more entertaining than the men. I thought that Federer winning 20 is a great story, but you know what? Carolyn Wozniacki finally, 10 years into this thing, validating her number one ranking, that was a nice story too. I thought that the theater and the drama was just as good.
The quality of the matches all around were better on the women's side.
I totally agree with that.
Pure entertainment-wise too, people like to say that women's sports are not as entertaining as men sometimes, and I think this tournament totally blew that out of the water.
I'm totally with you. I also think that, someone that's interesting we could talk about is Maria Sharapova, but also remember, too, that without Serena Williams and without Azarenka, who I don't think we've talked about enough, two-time champion there, who, in theory is still kind of sort of in the prime of her career, there were some holes in the draw, and Sharapova did not come through yet again, former champion. We can talk a little bit about that. But I thought if we got a glimpse of the post-Serena world in women's tennis, we're going to be okay here.
I agree. Let's talk about your favorite person to talk about.
Who's that?
Nick Kyrgios.
Oh, Jamie.
I'm
kind of fascinated with Kyrgios.
In four sets, not blown out. I mean, four tight sets.
Oh, good match.
In the fourth round, he played pretty well throughout the whole tournament. I mean, he was very contained and, seemed very focused. Do we feel that this is sort of something that will stick around? I mean, he also played very well going into the tournament. Can you see him sort of gradually making his way up. I mean, Dimitrov sort of had that last year where he little by little made his way up, and you know, he had a great end of the year, and now he's continued that into 2018. Maybe will we see that with Kyrgios this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to define our terms. I mean, can he keep going up? Yes. Will his ranking get higher? Yes. Is he ready to win majors?
No.
That I don't think so. But no, I liked what I saw from Kyrgios. I mean, I also think, and I wrote about this a little bit, he is such a mystifying guy in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, he's had one indefensible act with Stan Wawrinka, which now almost 3 years ago. But, I mean, that was just whatever, a red card, whatever you want. That was just indefensible. All his other lapses are of the self-sabotaging variety. I also think that the one thing I wrote about it, that I noticed he's the whole tennis establishment he doesn't have much use for, and he, you know, pick your cliche, plays to his own drumbeat, and he, you know, rejects tennis convention. But there's a real kind of likable populism to him. He spends a lot of time with kids. He spends a lot of time with the crowds. He wants to play on these smaller, more intimate stadiums. He's not the kind of guy who's sort of jetting in and jetting out. I mean, you see him walking around the grounds, and he's talking about basketball. And I think his maturity is catching up to his physical talents. But it's really unique, I think, to see a young athlete like that who does things his own way, but sort of gravitates to the people. I thought we saw maturity from him. We didn't see the usual. I mean, remember, in 2017, he was literally booed off the court. Mm-hmm. Much different this year. I think the fans have taken to him a lot more. And I'd say B-plus tournament, maybe. Great for the first week. A winnable match against Dimitrov, who then lost to Kyle Edmund. So that's got to sting a little bit extra for Kyrgios. Kyrgios gets through that match, and he very easily could have been in the semifinals.
Yeah.
But no, I think this is a work in progress. And again, I mean, playing in Australia, playing in your home slam is a different set of pressures than when he goes elsewhere. He played doubles, which in retrospect, maybe not the smartest thing. At the same time, kind of cool that one of the big stars of the tournament is out there on court two on a hot Thursday playing a three-set doubles match. I'm not sure I would advise him to do that if I were his coach, but I like that he thinks in those terms. So he remains a mystifying figure. I think there's some good signs, some good takeaways. I still think he needs a coach. I mean, there were times when he was playing Dimitrov, and they would show Dimitrov's box, and you look over, and there was, you know, Danny Valverdeur, there were two guys in the box. And then they would show Kyrgios's box, and it was absolutely packed. But then you realized it wasn't, and he was yelling at him about his rackets, and he was telling him to stand. I don't know how people do. Can you imagine, you know, 20, you know, you're a, I'm a grown ass man.
Should
and
we stand?
Yeah,
do
exactly.
We stand?
Exactly.
Do we sit? That was a funny,
you saw that.
Yeah.
But it also occurred to me there wasn't an actual tennis mind
Andy
in the
Murray
box.
Andy Murray written all over it, though.
I mean, exactly. But at least Andy Murray has
multiple
sort of, you know, Ivan Lendl sitting there, and he's one of the, and then Mauresmo before him, and Jez Green, and
I'm on your side when it comes to Kyrgios. I think a lot of people.
I mean, overall, I think he's a force of good. He's exciting. I mean, I think fundamentally he's a good guy. I did think it was funny though that he had his doubles partner was sort of playing the role, but there wasn't a font of tennis wisdom for all the people in his box. It was the brother, and you know, the agent, and the publicist, and the parents, but there wasn't an actual
pure
tennis mind
moral
in there.
Support.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's
tactical.
A good way to put it. Yeah, exactly. So he was with Sebastian Grosjean. That did not continue. I think we were talking last year about, I had a couple people tell me, you want to be the coach after the coach for Nick Kyrgios. So you don't want to take him now. You want to be the one who comes when he's 26. And I think now, if he held up a vacancy sign, I think a lot of people would be intrigued. I think he's come a long way in the last year.
Do you think he will do that though, or do you think he's waiting for someone to come to him?
I mean, I think there are ways, and you know, agents play a role in this too, of sort of sending out, hey, if you're interested, yeah, I may have an opportunity for you. I just think right now he probably doesn't want to coach, and it's going okay. I mean, as you say, he played well in the tune-ups, and getting to the you know, getting to the fourth round and losing to Dimitrov's nothing to be ashamed of. It was a high level match. Could have, you know, tiebreakers could have gone either way. But no, I mean, I just, what is the, what's the ceiling for this guy? I guess is my question. I think everyone sees the talent. Everyone knows the talent. Will he put it together to win majors? Is this Murat Safin who wins a couple majors and has a good time and is always dangerous, but also has some disappointment?
At least he's not getting bit by snakes or something on some reality TV show. At least.
Oh, wow. Is that a Bernie Tomic reference you're throwing?
Yes.
I think we need to uncouple Kyrgios from Bernie Tomic, by the way. But anyway, what I'm curious to you. This was a big topic in Australia, but also people writing to me. Was the website, the technology?
Yes.
And it started out as like, oh, the website's slow, and people a lot of times gripe about this. And then I actually...
It was awful.
Awful, right?
Yes.
Which to me is just stunning. I mean, everyone's always displeased with technology, right? Everyone, you look at ratings for apps, and no one's ever says, this piece sings, it's flawless. But I was absolutely shocked. I mean, the Australian Open...
It's usually great.
Anyone that's been there... sees this firsthand, the bean bags and the water spritzers, and there are always some innovations, and the players love it, and they bring in the koala bears. I mean, literally every touch has been thought of. And I think from the fan experience, yeah, every previous years it's been great, right?
Yeah, I mean, their social media is awesome. They, you know, the website is usually very clean. They're very good about updating things, and, you know, it's usually very spelled out where you can get certain information on the website. The app was full of errors the first couple days. You could not get a score.
Stats. I mean, you still couldn't.
Stats were terrible. The thing, too, was that, I mean, the U.S. Open has a reputation for, you know, mixing up photos. You know, Nadal is playing and it's...
That's what
Yelena,
I mean. Exactly. Yeah,
face,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Fine. Like, that's really funny. We can laugh at that. But, like, at least the scores are correct.
Well, at least it's functional.
Yeah. But when... I mean, I'm literally not there sometimes. Like, literally not in Australia. So I'm... I need scores. Like, I need something that I can count on. I mean, when you're sitting in a media room at a tournament, the tournament provides you with the scores, and you know, you have a computer right
in
front of me.
In the press room, there was a lot of, like, screw it, I'm just going to Google this stuff.
Yeah.
It was stunning. And I think the other thing is that this event, probably more than any other major, really positions itself as global. It's the Grand Slam of Asia-Pacific, and they have an office in China we always hear about. I just don't know how this happens. I mean, it's just absolutely baffling to me. This is, you know, the New York Times forgetting to run spell check on the front page. I mean, this is just such a fundamental error. And for a tournament, again, that, like, has beanbags where players can relax.
No,
I mean,
and their social media account, I mean, they're on it in terms of, like, during the finals, like, they'll get you GIFs and videos of, you know, Federer wiping tears off his face like seconds after it happens. Like, I mean, they deliver in that respect, whereas some other tournaments' Twitter accounts and things are not so great. You know, they have it all together in that respect. It's just...
This was the upset of the tournament, and I also feel like we all got a glimpse of when the technology isn't up to speed, it really changes the entire experience. Yeah, this was you hope that's corrected, because this was just the first day. I'm like, this, I didn't even know if
they've
I was on the right site.
Figure it
yeah,
out,
they've got
so.
A year to figure it out. Exactly. What else can we talk about real quick in our remaining time? Sasha Zverev, another disappointment.
I was going to ask you about the big story. Talk about Twitter, Mr. Sandgren and. Yeah. His whole situation.
Oh, we have to go there.
You want to go there? I mean,
yeah,
I know you said your piece sort of and explained it all, and you guys had a good conversation on Tennis Channel about it. You know, the implications just generally for, you know, not just him, but the implications generally of social media accounts and what you post there and what your interactions are there. But we should probably.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is, I think this goes way beyond Tennis Sandgren. I mean, this was really sort of a cultural discussion. Obviously, in this polarized time we live in, responses were all over the map, from this is appalling and disgraceful to what does this have to do with tennis? You snowflake, some of the players got into it. I think the bottom line is that this wasn't just one or two tweets. This seemed to be something resembling a pattern over years. Some of these were indefensible. I think that, I give Tennis Sandgren some credit. I mean, you know, you look at it's a bit of a false equivalency, but I brought this up in the context of Margaret Court, who stands by her views and only men and women should be married, and this is how I think. Tennis Sandgren, actually, his tweets the past few days have indicated that he's reconsidered this. He's made some apologies. He's made some reassessments. He's disavowed the alt-right. I also think this is a story that, I mean, so often in sports you have a scandal and it happens and we figure out how we react to it. There's a doping test. We figure out how severely, what side are you on, or how severely do you want to sanction the player? I think with this, it's evolving, and his ranking is such he's going to be playing a lot of events. He'll have a lot more time to be asked about this. He's going to have to interact with colleagues. I mean, I think this is a fluid story, and I think it's at some level, you know, it's actions over words.
There was
a long statement, and people picked it apart. And you know, again, I mean, I thought that when he read his initial statement in the press conference, I thought that was a little bit disingenuous. I mean, first of all, sort of casting yourself as the victim seemed like it was a little bit tone deaf. It also, he walked in there and read this quote, and I wasn't sure, was this a Bible verse? Was this some Ayn Rand quote? And then you realize, oh, shit, that's, a statement that he's written. So then you sort of wanted to say, whoa, back up. Let me take notes on this. I didn't know what the context was. I mean, it was really weird.
It was directed at the media, too.
But he just sort of walked in. He didn't say, like, no questions. First, I want to read something I wrote. And he just walked in and started reading his phone, and it read like a quotation from, again, I thought he was quoting Ayn Rand or something. And then I realized, oh, this is a statement. And the whole thing played a little strange, and you wanted to sort of raise your hand and in some level, I wish I had, and said, listen, this statement's all well and good, but here you have got this platform. Specifically, are there apologies you want to make? Is there anything you want to walk back? Are there clarifications you want to make? It just seemed a little bit too pat to read a statement. But again, I mean, I think his subsequent statements suggested, if nothing else, he's given this thought. I spoke to him before any of this came to light. I spoke to him earlier in the week for Tennis Channel, and you know, I want to choose my words carefully, but you know, he seemed like a philosophical guy you could have a conversation with. Yeah. I think that this alt-right, some of the retweets were justifiably appalling to a lot of people, but again, I think the fact that he has walked away and hasn't done what Margaret Court's done and sort of owned it. I mean, at some level, he's said, look, I'm a work in progress. And again, the fact that he's issuing apologies, cynically, you could say, is this his sponsor? Cynically, you could say, oh, now he's dealing with the fallout and he doesn't want to get booed when he plays. But, you know, I still think it says something about the guy that he's recognizing that this is controversial and he's reassessing. And again, I think we see how this plays out. I mean, at some level, what happened here? Somebody made a series of tweets. And again, I mean, I think this was more than just one or two ill-considered remarks. I mean, there did seem to be something resembling a pattern here. But he's free to follow whoever he wants to follow, retweet who he wants to tweet out. People are entitled to get outraged, and I think there was certainly a fair amount of that. And now we'll sort of see what this brings. You're right, Jamie. It is a reminder that tweeting is forever. I suspect 5 years ago, whenever it was that, quote, his eyes were bleeding, he did not anticipate that he was going to reach the Australian Open quarterfinal and this was going to be international news. But those are the risks you undertake on social media.
Well, yeah, I think I didn't think it was fair. Like, you can't judge someone or whatever for following or viewing certain accounts. I think we all sort of follow or look at certain people that we may not support or, you know, like or believe in their viewpoints, right? But I think when it is grounds for discussion is when the interactions or, you know, something with that kind of content or that person, that's when you can sort of start to ask questions. So the fact that he deleted everything.
Yeah, which way? I mean, that's another thing, too. Somebody's going, how cowardly is that? The flip side to me, I mean, again, I think it's too easy to just sort of say, hey, everyone deserves a second chance. Let's start fresh. But I think the flip side of that is it's too callous to say he's made his own bed and now let's castigate the guy. I mean, the fact that he's deleting tweets suggests to me that maybe he's reconsidering some of his I mean, I let's just see how this plays out. I think is my
I agree.
My takeaway.
Lesson learned is that like
you are
said,
what you tweet.
Yes, I totally stand by that. Any last bit here, I guess, any sort of forecasting, big takeaways? I mean, everyone should go on SI.com and read your 50 thoughts, but any other takeaways besides those?
Other than the 50 thoughts? No, I mean, I think that a lot of times the Australian Open sets up the year, right? So we had Rafa Roger, and that ended up being the storyline of 2017, and they split the four majors. And we had Serena Williams beating Venus. Obviously, we then shortly thereafter learned about Serena's pregnancy. But sometimes the Australian Open is this nice sort of precursor to the year. I think this year, who knows? I think both men's and women's tennis is wider open than it's been in a long time. I mean, ironically, the women's draw was probably more formful than the men's. We hadn't seen that in a while. But Caroline Wozniacki has something to build on. To a lesser extent, Simona Halep does. Roger Federer has now won three of the last five majors. Health is going to be a big issue. But you didn't have the feeling that the Australian Open sort of was this précis. You didn't have the feeling that the Australian Open was this harbinger that's going to set the storylines in place for the year. It was a strange tournament. In the end, not particularly surprising. Both number two seeds won. If I had said to you 2.5 weeks ago, Jamie, Roger Federer and Wozniacki are going to win the titles, you'd say, yeah, it's about right. I could see that. This was not Ostapenko. Injuries problematic, but we are off and running on 2018, and Roger Federer is still riding high. That would be my headline.
Sounds
that
good.
All right, pleasure. We will have a guest in a few days, but that is a wrap up on the 2018 Australian Open. Thanks everyone for listening. Thanks for all your suggestions, tweets, texts during the tournament. You can get this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. You can feel free to leave a rating. Thanks, as always, to Jamie, who does a great job here. And we will have a guest in another podcast in a couple days. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Get some sleep.